All right. Well, Travis Newstep of Vestla Copper, welcome to Radiant Creators today. You definitely, your company has a great social media presence. I really can't get on Facebook and not be tempted by your amazing water bottles that you've got right there. And so, well, thanks for hopping on. It's been an interesting scheduling journey, but we were able to connect. And so tell us, it's on your website, of course, and I can even share that screen and we can look at it, but you've got an amazing product. It's maybe new here in the States, but not new in India. So how did Vestla Copper come to be?
Yeah, thanks, Craig. I appreciate the introduction. My daughter was asking for some snacks just now, so that's what I was doing.
That's fine.
But yeah, you're right about that. I was working long hours at my day job as a longshoreman down at the Port of Virginia. And sometimes I would work all day and I would sleep in my car and work the next day. And I noticed really quickly my water bottles were getting funky. I mean, they tasted horrible the next morning and I'd have to, you know, go find a sink and wash them out and put new water in them or else I wouldn't be drinking enough water. And, you know, it was pretty not that big of a deal, but, you know, it was something I had to do every day. And so one day I was at an Indian restaurant and I noticed they were serving water in copper vessels. So I asked about it and they told me a little about the sacred art of Tamarjal, which is what they call it in Ayurveda, which is it's literally translated to the science of life. Comes from the same place as yoga from the Vedic texts. And it's a sacred practice in India where they store water in copper overnight, and there's nutritional benefits there. It's antimicrobial, and there's also a spiritual aspect to it where they believe in Hindu that it can actually basically bring you more in touch with the gods, more in touch with divinity. So I thought it was super cool. I bought one because they were selling copper bottles on the shelf. They weren't as pretty as the ones that we sell, but they were there, and I bought one and I loved it. And I used it for 2 years. I bought my wife one, and I noticed the first thing I noticed is that my water didn't get funky. I could use it for 2 years, and then it never tasted like there was anything growing in it. And the water dispensers at work, they're the like 5 gallon jugs. And it's actually spring water, which I prefer, but the little nozzle that you turn to let the water come out.
Yeah.
You're supposed to clean them every month with vinegar, but they don't do that. So like, if you look down in there, it's like green, you know,
yeah,
algae. And, so it's kind of a joke at work that, you know, it's the water's suspect, but that doesn't matter with these copper bottles. If you let it sit 15 minutes, it actually starts. The antimicrobial effects actually kick in within 15 minutes. Within 3 hours, any microbes in there are significantly like reduced. Basically, they're not killed completely, but they're weakened so much that they're not going to have an effect on you. And if you let it sit for 8 to 12 hours, depending on, you know, the contamination level and what kind of water and everything, then it'll be completely void of microbial growth and beyond the point of resuscitation in a laboratory. Like they can't even bring it back to life with the things that the methods that they try in lab settings. So that's really cool. So I was doing all this research on it and I fell in love with it. It raises the pH of your water slightly. I just kept reading, and that copper in general is a really, really fascinating material, a natural element. So I wanted to have a company like this, an e-commerce company. I wanted to start one for a long time, but I was waiting to find the right product. So I was like, this is the right time. We got to do this. Unfortunately, my wife was pregnant and it wasn't the right time for my family. But, you know, I think with something like this, there's never going to be the right time. So I went ahead and did it anyway. And told her that I would take care of everything with the launch. And then, you know, after we had the baby and she was kind of settled down after she recovered, she could join with me, and you know, here we are. She helps me run the business, and we're doing really well, and I'm learning more about copper. You know, I'm dabbling in electroculture and other things, and I'm, you know, really fascinated with the energetic spiritual things with copper. I mean, I could go on and on, you know.
I think right now we're in the midst of a copper renaissance, and it's interesting how things hit the collective, you know, consciousness like that, because, well, copper is not necessarily new to India, you could say, but you know, here in the States, it's fairly an awakening, and so now we have electric culture, which. I guess that's not really new either. That's old, but it's been forgotten, let's say, by the collective consciousness, by most people. But now it's almost getting not unusual to walk around your neighborhood and see a little you know, bamboo stick or a stick or something like that, and then copper wound around it next to people's tomato plants. So electroculture, which... to me, it's not far out, but I mean, to many people, it is far out. But the thing is, if someone says, yes, I make my little copper coil around a stick and I put it in my tomato plants and they grow more tomatoes. Or I have a sick garden and I put some in the garden and now the garden is thriving again. So if people get results, then, people will do it. You know, they might think, wow, that's a little bit crazy for me. But if it works and it works with their neighbor and then it works with the neighbor on the other side, then they'll, even if it's begrudging, they'll stick one in the ground. And next thing you know, things are working better. So how's electroculture going for you? So that's a new study for you. I mean, it is for me as well. And it's amazing the books that were written at one time on electroculture.
I know it is. It feels like it's, I don't know if it's suppressed or what's going on there, but it's definitely, if you look hard enough, you can find the books and the science that have been done showing the effects of it. But then if you just do a Google search, there's a lot of stuff that is discrediting it. And with, you know, in my experience, and that just makes me want to look harder because those are the things that are most interesting to me. If there's a reason that people want to like suppress it or not give it a chance, then I think it needs to be, you know, both sides of the equation need to be read up on and researched. And that's, I'm not an expert in electroculture by any means, but I've seen the testimonials like you're referring to. I've seen pictures of, you know, plants that grow 2-3 times as much as the control group. And this is not a small group of people. These testimonials are all over the place now. There's video evidence, there's pictures. And then there's the books and the studies that were done 100, 200 years ago, in North America and in Europe, and Russia and, you know, all these places. And so we're just kind of dabbling in it. Honestly, like my yard is, I'm still in the process of like landscaping. So I'm not heavily gardening yet. We do have a house, but we bought the house 5 years ago. We've had to restore the greenhouse. A lot of the wood was rotted and we've kind of got the backyard where we want it, but there's so many weeds and things that need to be dealt with before I actually start growing. You know, I got some stuff growing, but before I really take it seriously. And then the business is blowing up, so it's kind of devoted most of my time to that right now. But yeah, it's super interesting, and I've followed, like, you know, the Cultivate Elevate channel and all the stuff they post about it. And so we got a couple coils going in our greenhouse, just doing some microgreens, and got some tomatoes sprouting, some lettuces sprouting on the bed, but it's all real new, so I don't have any like results or anything cool like that.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the nice things about something like electroculture or copper water bottles, of course, is that people can put it to the test. You know, if a person wants to know, they can just try it and they'll see. So I think something that truly works just proves itself. You know.
Yeah. Do you have any? Are you doing electroculture?
Yes. Yeah. Some outside and then some inside. Like every plant eventually gets a little, every house plant, a thing we have growing in the house has a little spiral in it, almost every. And then we just have some big ones in the house because they're good for the energy of an area as well. And so we have some nice big copper twirlies, I guess you could call them, the house. And so they're a wonderful thing. And, you know, I think that, you know, a business somebody could create is actually making beautiful ones, because they're good for an area, they're good for a garden, but I would say that they're enlivening to a house, to an area as well. And I mean, that would be, there'd be another startup business, is just beautiful electroculture for the home, you know, because some people already make incredibly ornate ones. But I think with that, with the copper spirals, there's a lot of artistic medium right there to do amazing things. I mean, so.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can just, from my experience with the copper bottles, just like having copper around you, the way it shines and the vibrant energy of it, it brightens up your day. It's a real thing. I mean, you in India and in ancient civilizations that used copper, copper is known to bring abundance. And it's known to basically also help let go of things that aren't productive and make way for new things that are productive. So, you know, people have been using copper for thousands of years. You go back to ancient Egypt and they were using copper plumbing in some of the structures, some of the pyramids and stuff there. In fact, there's actually copper plumbing from a structure in Egypt. I believe it was one of the pyramids that is still intact in a museum in Germany to this day.
Really?
And when I tell people that, they're like, well, how come my plumbing in my house after 60 or 70 years, you know, it starts to corrode? I'm like, well, the tap water is so bad that it, you know, it's slightly acidic. And it's got fluoride, it's got chlorine in it. And chlorine is, you know, not only do these things make water more acidic, but it's actually speeds up the tarnishing rate of copper. And that's why it's corroding. If you put clean 7.8 pH spring water or groundwater in copper pipes, they'll last forever. And it's funny because one of the things with our bottles is the inside, you know, tarnishes. The outside's covered with a food grade lacquer. But the inside, like you can kind of see on this one, it's got just a little bit of black speckles on there. And that's normal, you know, for copper to tarnish. And if you don't clean it, it'll turn into a patina, you know, over the course of a month or two. But it's really interesting because I put in 7.8 Mountain Valley spring water. It's the best water. I could go on a tangent about Mountain Valley. It's my favorite water. It tastes amazing. It's got minerals in it. But my bottles don't tarnish very quickly at all. I clean mine maybe every like 3 or 4 weeks. Sometimes I've gone 2 months without cleaning them, and they do tarnish, but not as quickly as, you know, if you're using filtered water from a tap, which is going to be, you know, basically not alive. It's not living. Yes. It's dead water is how people refer to it. 'Cause water doesn't want to be in pipes, you know, water wants to be in a stream or a spring or, you know, a copper bottle. We kind of mimic some of those characteristics, but, so it's funny 'cause some of my customers are like, oh, it's tarnishing. It's after the first time I use it. And well, what kind of water did you put in? If you put in tap water, it's going to tarnish quickly because of all that crap in it. And then, you know, even if you filter the tap water, even with a really good filter, you know, it's still water that came from the tap. Water has memory. And that I believe
it does
shown in the science. You know, people will debate that, but I think it's been shown in the science clearly. Water science is a very taboo subject that scientists want to stay away from.
Oh yeah. But
people like Gerald Pollack have kind of shown that, and you know, the Japanese fellow.
Emoto, right? The Emoto, water crystals.
Yeah. So the water going through the pipes, it remembers all that, and it remembers the water treatment facility, it remembers all the stuff that we dumped down the drain. You know, it's just like you wanna kind of cleanse that energy. And that's what copper can do. It can, and you know, I'm not going to claim that in my marketing because I can't point to any science that says, hey, copper will cleanse the energy of your water and make it happier, basically. But that's what I believe is going on. And there is a little tiny bit of science that needs to be studied more that shows that copper kind of restructures water Are you familiar with structured water at all?
You know, I've heard the term structured water a good number of times, and I'm still not exactly sure the definition of it.
So basically, like if you go and get water from a spring in the mountains or a glacial melt and you put it under a microscope, it's structured differently molecularly. It's the molecules are actually hexagonally shaped there. And instead of H2O, it's actually, I forget, it's got a different pattern. But it's basically the hydrogen. I'll have to Google it, but there's an extra hydrogen or something. And it makes it go into a diagonal, really structured formation. And that basically, it's also known as exclusionary zone. In the scientific literature, it's known as exclusionary zone water. Gerald Pollack did a lot of work on it, and he showed that basically water has a fourth state, and that's this structured state. It's almost gel-like. And that's also the reason there's surface tension on water. The prior explanations that we were taught in school have been picked apart by scientists like Gerald Pollack. That doesn't really explain why the surface tension happens. Actually, what's happening at this layer is there's a small exclusionary zone of water that is in a fourth state. It's structured. And that's what allows it to have surface tension and all these other phenomena with water. Like if you have like a droplet of water on your car, like you're driving 60 miles an hour, but this water droplet doesn't.
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed that phenomenon? I was in the car. Yeah. The other day, I noticed it. It's because the heat from the sun and warms up your car and basically structures that drop of water. So it's more like a gel than a liquid, because the liquid water, that part that was all liquid, it already went away. It goes away pretty, it drips and it goes to the ground, right?
Yeah.
So it's super interesting, but more science needs to be done on it. But there is, you know, some people that are saying that's what copper does too, is that you let it sit overnight, it restructures the water. So
that makes sense. Yeah. And I think the spring water is a big deal, where the structured water, spring water, very lucky to live down the hill from Sedona here. And there's natural springs in Sedona, and some are, well, one especially is extraordinarily easy to get to. And so you can go fill up there. And the nice thing about that water is, think about Sedona and the whole the vortex is that people talk about. Well, some of the foundation of that really comes from, if you ever go to Sedona and you see a piece of rock, you'll notice that there's crystals in it. So that the natural red rock there is just crystal ridden. And so there's so much quartz crystal in the rock that goes really, really deep. And so when you get the spring water from Sedona, you're getting this beautiful, like, crystal enriched, like, I mean, I know I sound drastically like New Agey, so everybody, you know, forgive me, but that's me. You get this sort of like crystal vortex enriched spring water. And the first, I always knew it was better because it tastes better. I mean, a person can just, spring water is an experience. If you've only drunk tap water before, or even filtered water, you haven't really experienced water. I mean, it's amazing when you get it from the spring. But something that really struck me is, if you boil it, it sounds different. So I would say, and that got me. So I was making coffee in the morning and had a bunch of spring water. We drive up there, fill up a whole bunch of, you know, containers, and come down about once a month. And I just realized one morning I'm boiling the water, and I was like, that sounds different. So I had to even do a test. Okay. Regular water out of the, you know, reverse osmosis filter, then spring water. And it has a different sound. So there's an experiment. Yeah. So, and that'd be kind of, yeah. So it'd be kind of curious if an experiment maybe people could do is you take your water of choice. Maybe spring water won't work for this experiment, but put it in one of your copper containers, your copper water bottles, let it sit overnight and boil it in the morning and see if it sounds different. That'd be an amazing test.
Wow. Yeah, that would be. It's like boiling like tap water versus spring water versus copper infused water.
Yes. See how it, that'd be really something, a great test. Well, because there are, there's a company, and I honestly don't know the company name, but I've seen them. They make a copper pipe that has the vortex in it, the twist in it.
Yeah, I've seen stuff like that.
Yeah, and I can't speak to the effectiveness of it or not, but even that is something I think that is fairly new in the last few years. It didn't exist before.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, yeah, a few hundred years or a couple hundred years. I think, what was the guy that discovered that vortex? He was a logger in Austria, I think. And he was, doing work on logging and like log flumes down rivers. And he found that the vortex of the river is what helped, the water basically carry the logs, the heavier logs over the river. So when they built the flumes, they actually incorporated the vortexing water into the flumes, and that made them be able to transport the logs a lot, like way more efficient, like three times more efficient. He was it Victor somebody? Victor Schubert? Something like that. I should have had some notes. I'm trying to move. I noticed I was in bad light. I'm trying to stay outside, but I'm gonna move indoors.
Oh, it's a great garage you got there, or a workshop, or both. Yeah, there you go.
All of the above.
Oh, I like it. That's awesome. That's a nice looking garage. Well, yeah. So so your water bottles are those made in India and then shipped here, or are they made really?
They're all handmade in India. They hold copper to be sacred. They have generations of experience in coppersmithing. So they're made in India. They're shipped over here. And then they're stored in my garage warehouse. And we're probably going to have to rent a warehouse space this year because we're growing so quickly. But it all started, I had this garage built in my backyard specifically to use as a warehouse. And it's been great because I can just walk out the back door.
Yeah.
Barefoot in my grass and ground a little bit, I could, I could basically work from home, and I got three kids, and I'm still transitioning out of my other job. So, and then we have a couple other businesses as well. So it's been nice to just have it here. But yeah, the copper bottles are all right here.
Yeah. Let's see the warehouse. Huh. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. We're about to get a new shipment in, so we're running kind of low. They've been selling really quickly, and it'll be filled up again.
And so business is really doing quite well. So so what's that like? You went from idea, or inspiration, one might say, of the copper containers, and then now you're doing it. And as you're saying, it's taking off. So is this getting to be full time, or is that the plan? Does it look like it's going to support that?
I have my mother-in-law helping fulfill bottles. I got a marketing team, and we did over 62,000 in revenue last month.
Wow. Okay.
We're actually, we're trying out for Shark Tank on Friday.
Oh, wow.
Shark Tank. It's not like the actual TV show pitch, but it's the preliminary tryouts to see if we make it on the actual show. And that's just to basically get more inventory, because since they're all made by hand, it takes a while to get the inventory. So if we have a lot of money up front, we can basically order a ton of inventory, and then we can scale quicker. And we've sold out three times already, and it's people want the bottles, and I got to make them wait. So it'll help a lot with funding for a big order. And I'll probably have like three different companies over there, because I get samples from all these different coppersmithing companies over in India, and I've narrowed it down to a few that I think are the best quality, and they're really good to deal with. And so I'll have multiple manufacturers working to, they're all generational artisans that are will be making it by hand. And so I'll have three different companies with several artisans all making these by hand. And so we'll be able to hopefully do sell like 20 or 30,000 this year.
Wow.
Do 1.2 million in revenue. And I think we can hit that in 2024.
Wow. So. That's awesome. And that's all doing, and that's doing copper. Well, I will say your marketing team is great. I mean, your Facebook presence is, it's good. I mean, it's great artwork. Well, great pictures, great placement. I mean, yeah, it's one of the reasons why I contacted you is I really can't use Facebook without seeing your product, which is good because, you know, it's targeted marketing. It's something that I'm interested in. And the all the ads you're doing, they're pleasant. You know how some things, I'm not a big Facebooker, but it's just that if a person does use Facebook, you know how some ads can become absolutely grinding and grueling. And you say, please don't show me this again. Please don't show me this again. It's like, no, you're going to see this again. I'm like, you know, but yours, the nice thing is they're aesthetically pleasing. So, I mean, it's great. It's great marketing. I mean, and it's a great product, and that probably helps, you know?
Yeah, it does. And like you said before, I think we got kind of ahead of a trend, kind of renaissance. So the other part of that is basically we've been told by science that copper deficiency is rare for years. And that goes back to like 50 or 60 years ago when they basically did bad science. They didn't take into consideration in the studies they did that we actually lose copper in our sweat. If you're exercising, if you live in, you know, Arizona and it, you know, it's hot, yeah, you're sweating a lot, right? You're losing more copper than people who don't sweat a lot. And, you know, they only took into consideration the excretionary methods of, you know, fecal and urinary excretion of copper. We're also losing it in our sweat. So they didn't get it right. They set the recommended daily amount at like 0.9 milligrams, and that was way below what it should have been. And that basically is where all this false information on copper came from. And even like orthodox science is basically coming to a consensus that copper deficiency is actually way more prevalent than we've been told and we've been led to believe. And copper toxicity is actually a lot rarer than people want to convince you. It's like this scare tactic thing. Oh, copper toxicity. And, you know, it's really, so you got to get to like 10 milligrams of copper, and copper is a trace mineral. So we're talking really small amounts, but 10 milligrams of copper to get to like a toxic level to where, and that level is not going to have long-term effects. It's going to basically make you have diarrhea and have an upset stomach, and then your body gets rid of it quickly and you'll be fine the next day. It actually is a detox. It actually will actually binds to your toxins in your body and basically gets them out. So what the recommended daily amount should be just to, for like the average person who doesn't even sweat a lot, is like 2 milligrams to 3 milligrams. And Dr. D. Nicolantonio, have you heard of that
guy? I've heard the name for sure. Yeah.
He's really good. He wrote a book called The Mineral Fix. He talks about this phenomena. Everything I just mentioned, I learned from him. And so when you store water in your bottle overnight, all the claims that you hear from the Tom Rajal advocates, the Ayurvedic practitioners from India, you know, that it's good for, to beat anemia, it's good for thyroid function, cognitive function, heart health, et cetera, energy, collagen formation, stem cell activity. All these things are because you're getting copper in your diet. Copper is an essential mineral. It's an essential nutrient. So you get about 0.4 milligrams up to 0.4 milligrams of copper from your water bottle if you're storing it overnight. You get a little bit just from having it throughout the day as well. So that's well within the safety limits. You're not going to get toxicity, you know, because basically 2 to 3 milligrams is what you want to hit just to not be deficient. There's people that are athletes, people that are sweating a lot, trying to hit 6, 7, 8. They're trying to get past 10, actually. I know people that actually are making copper salve and rubbing it on their skin.
Oh, yeah.
And so that they can get like 30 milligrams a day or 50 milligrams, because our stomach could only handle up to 10 milligrams at a, you know, about per day or at a time. So, you know, they take 8 or 9 milligrams orally, and then they'll actually try to get another 30 on topically. And that's because our stomach is basically, it's getting all these toxins into it, and then we have to expel it quickly.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing, because you want to get that stuff out, but it's not comfortable. I don't recommend doing that. But
yeah, so
it's really interesting, the science is coming out. So yeah, that's where I was going with it. The Journal of Nutritional Science at Cambridge University, right? Huge, prestigious scientific journal. They released an article in October of 2022. And it was titled "The Contemporaneous Epidemic of Copper Deficiency," right? And this wasn't just one study. They cited 80 different peer-reviewed studies with over 9,000 different cases, people, where they had different conditions from Alzheimer's to osteoporosis to thyroid dysfunction and all these different things. And they supplemented copper and their symptoms improved. So this is textbook deficiency, right? Like, this is obviously these people were deficient. And so then if you look at, I think the best information on minerals and the way that they work in our body, basically it's Morley Robbins's work. And he wrote a book called Cure Your Fatigue, but cure is like C-U, like the atomic symbol of copper with the box around it. And then are you cure your fatigue? And he talks about how basically the reason that people are depleted in copper is a number of reasons, but one of the biggest ones is chemical farming, obviously the glyphosate and the NPK fertilizer and all the chemical farming practices are basically depleting our soils of minerals. And they just replenish with nitrogen, potassium, and was it MPG? The other one, whatever it is. But those three things,
yeah, are, whatever K is,
base minerals and the microbes in the soil, right? For it to be like healthy cropland. So all of our plants are depleted. But copper and magnesium are the two biggest ones that they're depleted of. Also calcium and in some cases even iron. But so those are depleted. And then we're not eating the animals like we used to. We used to eat elk and deer and bison, which have more copper in them. And now we're eating, you know, beef, and we're not eating the liver and the heart anymore, which have copper in them. So all these things come together, and that's why we're deficient. They say half of people, up to half of in modern civilizations, are deficient in copper.
Yeah, and that's not surprising at all. And it's true. Yeah, we're definitely, well, there's another renaissance there as well, is the paleo ideal. You know, I mean, most people aren't quite so hardcore they live on like bone marrow, brains, and butter. I mean, they're not quite they're not totally paleo. And that can be a little bit shocking to the, you know, the domesticated person, like, I gotta eat what, you know. But that's what a hamburger used to be. That's the thing about how things have changed, is where, you know, I don't know, it wasn't necessarily on purpose for health, but hamburger used to be all that stuff. So it was meat, but also it was all that stuff. It was the brains, it was the liver, it was everything. And now I've heard it called ancestral hamburger. So at the farmers markets now, and some butchers, you can actually get ancestral hamburger, which is the whole stuff once again. And that can be a little bit unique to try. I mean, I'm a hunter, so I'm not bothered by it, and I'm used to eating all kinds of grisly stuff. I like it, but I would say that, wild meat and wild organs are, you know, it's a trip. But once you get used to it, you're good to go. But yeah, that can be shocking. And I would say that a much easier gateway item to get into that point where you're eating buffalo brains and such is definitely a nice copper water container.
Yeah,
you can wash them down with that.
Yeah. So do you prepare the organ meats and stuff when you hunt?
Yeah, I do. I do. And some of it is, that's the thing about hunting, is some of it is if you're in the field afterwards enough, like if you're by yourself or with some other people, especially, it's a little easier. So when you're hunting as a little group, because, you know, let's say it's an elk, let's say it's big, you know, that's kind of hard for one person to carry out. It might take a while, a few trips, you know, while you're fighting off coyotes and stuff. So, but with that, there's certain things that are really, you can't quite imagine when you're just sitting at home, but when you're out in the field and you go hunting, even if it's with other people and you're not the one who actually, you know, shot the elk or got it with their addle or whatever it might be, however a person's hunting, like putting the whole head in a campfire, you know, and then like cooking the head and like the brains and then like opening it up and eating it, you know, I know it sounds grisly, but somehow when you're out in the woods and you're on the hunt, these things seem very natural. It just changes the whole texture of the experience and how you literally experience it. And then like liver, one of the things that I realized that, you know, hunting was that most liver we get, even out of a butcher, is pretty gross. It really, really goes downhill really, really fast as far as an organ. So if you actually, if you actually pull it from the freshly slain animal and you sear it, you know, it's actually a whole different world. So if a person thinks that liver is nasty, I would say it kind of is, because it gets nasty really fast. But fresh liver is a whole different world. So yeah, all that is extremely energizing. And so you eat the best parts there, and then you just bring you bring the rest home. You know, and also if your partner in life is not a hunter, and doesn't necessarily appreciate it as much as you do, and wants anything that they eat nicely packaged, you know, wrapped in paper, it needs to look like it came from the butcher. You know, it's good not to bring heads and hearts and stuff like that home. You know, it doesn't go over well when they open the freezer. There's an elk skull looking at them. Yeah. Don't do that one, caveman. It doesn't go over well.
That's so interesting. So you eat what do you go for the liver first, and then what's your order of operations after you just make a kill?
I think it's liver, heart, and if you're up for it, the brains are very good, you know. And actually the head is really good too, because, you know, most people don't bring the head home, you know. I mean, like if you want to mount it on the wall, that's great, but honestly, it's heavy and there's not that much meat on it. So wrapped in tinfoil and put in the campfire in the coals, a nicely slowly broiled, slowly roasted head actually is, there's all kinds of meat on there, and the brains are good too. And I do believe, you know, from some study that the Indians here, the Native Americans here in America, the Plains Indians, and of course there was buffalo everywhere, but they're first thing was the liver, and they would squeeze the gallbladder onto it and they would eat that first raw, and then like number two and three was the brains and the tongue.
Brains and tongue, okay.
Yeah, so they would, and I guess because the brain is like, I guess, all cholesterol basically. It's all everything that they say we shouldn't eat a lot of, but it's quite good. And then, I mean, you can get into you know, animal fat too. I mean, you can render that out in the field or bring it home, and then you can use, you know, bear fat for your cooking oil. You can make your French fries in bear fat. That'll, that's a good conversation piece. You know, when you have to bring something to a dinner party.
Do you eat bear too?
I have. And it's,
the meat is pretty good.
What's that?
Is it good? Like the taste of the meat?
It all depends on what they've been eating. So, where I did hunting where bears were around. So in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State where I lived, there was deer hunting season overlapped bear hunting season. So most people, and so the bear tag was cheap, you know? And yeah. So if you were deer hunting and you happened to come across a bear, then you would maybe, if you wanted to, if it was, maybe you'd shoot it, you know? But the issue is, it depends on what they've been eating. So around that same time is when they're eating all the wild blueberries and wild blackberries. And the meat can have almost like a blueberry flavor. So sometimes bear can be really good. But if that thing has been parked on like a dead elk for two weeks, I mean, it is nasty. Oh my God.
Oh boy.
Yeah, you know, but I guess you're getting your copper, but yeah.
That's interesting. We just got back from North Carolina. We did a long trip up in the mountains, my family and I. We stopped in Chapel Hill. We live in Virginia Beach, and then we ended up in Western North Carolina in the mountains outside of Asheville. And we stayed at a place called Lake Lure, which was amazing. It's like where they filmed Dirty Dancing. Mm. My wife was all excited about that. And there's the Chimney Rock is beautiful. And, you know, it's the biggest mountains on the East Coast. They're actually, it looked like I was in like mini Yosemite or something. It's gorgeous over there if you ever get the chance to go. But there were some huge black bears coming to our house like every night and every morning and digging through the trash.
Oh, wow.
I've seen black bears hiking and stuff, but I had never seen one that big. This guy might've been 500 pounds or.
Wow.
He was huge. And my daughter dropped her stuffed animal off the balcony. She said, "Dad, we go get it." She's got, you know, we knew about the bears. So I told my kids not to go outside alone. It's like, yeah, I'll go out. And then I had walked outside that morning and I knew the trash was all over the place. I knew the bears were close by, but I didn't know that they were still in the area. So I walked out and I turned left and this is the front of the building. And she had dropped it off the back balcony and it kind of, the back it slopes down really, really steep. So I turned left and the bear's there and he's eating trash on the other side of the road. And I was just like, that's a big bear. But I was far enough away. I was already far enough out that I decided just to slip down the side of the building and run down and get the stuffed animal. So I ran down, I got it, and my family's there at the balcony, and I threw it up to him. Like, there's a huge bear over there. It's huge. And so then I walked back around the corner thinking it's still in the same spot. Like a road, you know, next to the building. And he was on the other side of the road with the other, at the other buildings eating their trash. He had crossed over the road and was right at the corner that I turned, staring down over a ledge at me.
Oh, wow.
20 to 30 feet away from this bear. And he was just staring at me like on this ledge. Like he could just jump over and be on me. And you're not supposed to run from them because, you know, their hunting instincts. This is what I was told. Safety people, their hunting instincts kick in. So I just kind of like turned and I ran and I jumped and climbed up the balcony. You know, and I had a knife and I bought a knife because the bears were out and they're around. It was a big knife, you know, big sharp new knife. But I don't know if I would have gotten anywhere with that guy because he was huge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're big.
It's the biggest one you've ever seen in the wild.
Wow. That's something. Yeah. I admire. I'm not sure if I admire them or I just think that they're silly, but I admire their tenacity. People who go bow hunting for bears. I just think because, you know, you're a max shot for most people is 50 yards, you know, and that's really close to be to a huge animal and piss it off.
Yeah, you hit him in the hand or something. He's all mad.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're smart. They know who did it. You know, they're gonna, yeah, you know, the arrow's pointing to you. Oh, he's over there. Yeah, so, yeah, so, well, it is a primal life, and it is good. So that's the thing about, you know, copper having a renaissance and electric culture having a renaissance. And I would say, honestly, hunting is having a renaissance because there's a lot of there's a great show, Meat Eater, you know, Steve Manella. It's a great, if a person likes hunting or has any interest, it's a great show. There's Remy Warren. There's another show called Solo Hunter. There's so many shows that have come out in the last few years about that have been out for a while now, and books that have been written that it's really making a renaissance. Like I was in the Pacific Northwest outside of Seattle across the bridge, and you know, hunters always go where nobody else does, and so I'm going down a road as far as it goes till it gets too crappy, and then I, you know, pull over and start hiking. And then a little further than I had gone, which was getting too rough for a truck, there was a Prius, and I walked past it, and there was two cases for Bose that, you know, in it. And I noticed on the back window, a little sticker that said Real Men Bow Hunt. And I was like, this is awesome. This is, I like this. These guys have a lot of tenacity. I mean, they drove their Prius into the forest.
And then they started I mean, if they shoot anything big, they must be going for bunnies or something to fit it in the Prius.
I know.
Did they have like a big plastic thing laid in the back or something?
I didn't see that. You know, it's true. They may not necessarily have had the whole thing thought out, but I admire that they were out there. And you know, and I would pay to see, you know, two guys driving a Prius back into Seattle with a deer slain across the roof, drinking water out of copper bottles. You know. That would be great. That'd be great. Wow. Well,
that's funny.
I mean, so we've covered a lot of ground, and I mean, I'm glad that I saw that you reposted, I don't know his full name. I know his name is Matt. We just call him Copper Matt. Cultivate, Elevate, you mentioned. I saw posted some things that he has done, and we don't know exactly where, but he lives right near us. We don't know exactly where, but he's here in Scottsdale. So we always hope to run into him sometime, and we've wanted to interview him, but we haven't quite gotten a hold of him. But he's here. He's close. He's right here. He's right here in town. So maybe I'll grab my iPhone one day and be like, hey, and like we'll chat in Whole Foods or something like that. You know.
Yeah, I keep trying to. You know, I want to collaborate with him too. He answers me back when we talk a little bit on Instagram, and a lot of people have found my business through him. I've turned some people onto him and his channel, and so we definitely have a mutually beneficial relationship. I've been really interested in all the stuff he talks about. Some of the stuff is like I'm right on board with. Some of the other stuff I'm still kind of questioning.
Yes.
But I definitely think that he's on the right train of thought. We should be questioning everything because we've been lied to. I mean, it's just fact that our government has lied to us, and it's just to the extent of how much they've lied about that, you know, you could argue, right? Because I mean, like the Kennedy assassination, for instance, it's all declassified. You can go read it. It was the CIA that did it.
Yeah.
Like, the government admits it. You know, openly, publicly, stuff. This just—I mean, some of it's like really easy to get behind. Then other stuff's like, okay, I almost feel like the government is like convoluting, like putting out so much false conspiracy theory information to actually basically discredit the real conspiracies that they've committed by association. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
I feel like that's happening, but so I'm skeptical of the skepticism, and but at the same time, I think he's on. I think a lot of the stuff he's saying is right on point.
Oh, it's right on, and that's the nice thing about I just call him Copper Matt. I don't know his last name or I forget it, but Copper Matt of Cultivate Elevate. He's great because he will always push you like right over the edge, like. You know, some things you'll just naturally like electric culture. It's like, yes, I get it. Of course, you know, and then some other things you're like, well, that's a little bit of a stretch for me, or I don't know, but that it is better to be on the edge than not. It's always good to be, you know, climbing that staircase of disbelief and pushing it harder because, you know, no matter how crazy it may seem, it usually turns out to be correct. So yeah. Odds are you're going to be right. You know,
right. Yeah. So where do you stand? Let's jump into the
yes.
topics. Like, what do you think about chemtrails? Are they real, or are they just is chemtrails just baloney? What do you think?
Now, I think they're real myself. I think they're real. We actually interviewed here on the show a few times Matt Landman, who he created the Franken Skies documentary, and I would say that all the technology and all the patents and all the fittings that planes would need exist. you know, and I think that there's pretty good evidence of, you know, photographic, at least I've never seen it in person, but companies manufacture it and such. I mean, there's planes full of great big tanks that spray the aerosols, and that's not even denied. I mean, like, cloud seeding is not denied. You know, it's so, I think it's all about what do you think is in them. That's the thing, because that can be done. You know, I just look at it like, if it's nefarious and being done on the scale that we look up and see, I mean, I got to think to myself, these planes don't have their little transponders on, so they're not being recorded, or we'd see them, because you can see every plane where it's flying around. And, you know, civilian aircraft can't turn those off, legally at least, but the military can, you know. And so you think, who's paying for that? One who's paying for it, right? But if the chemtrails are real and they're nefarious, that's not good, because they're spraying bad things on us. But at the same time, it's got to cost billions and billions a year to fly that many planes all the time. And talk about a secret. I mean, I know that they could keep it a secret, but there's got to be a tremendous amount of infrastructure behind these planes. So I just think that, well, anyway, what do you think? Do you think that, what's your take on them?
Oh, man, I don't know. I've kind of gone back and forth on it, because it's like, you got so many commercial airliners. You know, you go to the airport, you got Delta, you got JetBlue, you got, you know, American Airways, and, you know, United, and they're all flying, and it's like, they leave trails. So it's, yeah, like, are they in on it too? These are private companies, you know, like, mm-hmm, are they on it? Like, is it? And then, you know, I actually live in a big military area, you know, Norfolk, Virginia, Virginia Beach, huge Navy, Army, Marines, all of it. But most of the planes that I see flying are private jets, you know, like, yeah, if you look closely, like, you could tell the difference. The military planes look very unique. And anyway, so like, the trails are being left by all these private companies. And I'm like, are they in on it? That doesn't quite make that as much sense, because they don't work for the government. They're private companies. And then it's like, the explanation, you know, when I looked at the other side of it, because I was kind of sold on it for a while, and I looked at the other side of it, and the explanation that, like, NASA and the different people give us for why some chemtrails disappear and some don't, there actually makes a lot of sense scientifically to me. I know that cloud seeding's a thing. I know that there's patents for it. I know that they're doing weather modification. I'm absolutely 100% sure that's happening, but what scale? I'm not sold on the fact that it's a mass scale thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm also not sold, like Matt, for instance, and I'd love to talk to him about it, but he says that he was like, maybe clouds were like invented by the government. Like, maybe we should. that's just too far, because, you know, you can go back 3,000 years ago, they were drawing clouds on cave walls, you know, like, yeah, there's clouds have been a part of our history of art. You can look at art, like, all over, you know, you got Monet and, you know, people drawing clouds. There's been clouds forever. It's not just, it's very clear that evaporation happens and then clouds form from water. Like, this is very documented scientific water cycle stuff. Like, they're not making the clouds. So, like, at what point do you draw the line? I think people are taking it too far, yeah, but I don't know where that line is, and I am not super educated on it.
Neither am I.
That's, yeah, kind of where I'm not the expert on it. So I wanted to see what you thought. If you, yeah, have any, you can, like, give me some, sell me on it, please. Cause I'm,
it's,
yeah, it,
stuff. I'm, it's a not, tough one, because, yeah, it's, I mean, I would have to do more research myself, where I think that they're only supposed to make chemtrails like above 30,000 feet, cause it's cold or something like that. And so if you had a really good range finder, if you could see how high those planes are, you know, are they below that? Like, are they below where they should? And then, you know, I've always kind of wondered where it looks like the ones that are making the big fluffy chemtrails are below 30,000. It just looks like it to me. And then you have this chemtrail, or this contrail, that's slowly disperses. And then the whole sky is a milky cloud cover, you know, and you didn't, yeah, see any clouds come in. They all dispersed from this grid that they laid down. And then I'll think to myself, well, planes have to fly in, you can't just fly where you want over a city. You have to, well, for insurance reasons, all the commercial airliners, they, if you were to look at their little transponders, they all put it on autopilot and they come in and they fly over the exact same flight path, because that makes, because for one thing, that they have to in some cases, but also it makes the insurance cheaper. So they have to actually turn on autopilot, let the plane land so that they can validate that they flew a certain path in that is the safest and is, you know, and all this stuff for their insurance. So planes don't just fly in grid patterns over cities. You know, it creates a dangerous situation, because, you know, you don't really want planes flying over where if they happen to fall out of the sky, they land on things that you might not want them to. So unless they're a Boeing these days, which seems to be, I don't know, those things don't seem to be holding together too well. But anyway, I hear you. There's just so much data out there and then so many things that I'd have to give it a huge maybe. It's definitely possible. But yeah, is it really happening? I don't know. And then that's my thing. I think about, well, who's paying for it? Because it's got to be an incredibly expensive enterprise. You know?
Yeah, it does for sure. And if their objective is to block out the sun, is what Matt says, they're not doing a good job. You know, like it's sunny, you know, where I live, it's sunny, you know, 7 to 8 days out of 10. And it rains a lot here. I know it's sunny more in Arizona, right? It's pretty sunny there. So I'm like, yeah, maybe they're testing this stuff to block out the sun. I could see them testing it and see, you know, but they're definitely not doing a good job with blocking out the sun. And then they got those cloud busters that
the pyramids,
upper rods, and they, you put water on them or whatever, and it makes the clouds go away.
Cloud busters.
But, you know, I've seen the videos where it's like before it's all cloudy and then after, you know, but I'm not sold on it because I haven't seen a continuous video. It's like stop, edit. It looks like, you know, you got the cloud buster and then it's not a continuous video where the clouds go away. It jumps to another frame
and yes,
they're going away. Right. So it's like, well, that could easily be edited in a way to make it look like it's happening when it actually just a coincidence that 4, 5, 6 hours later, the clouds went away because the sun does melt clouds off. This happens. It's a phenomenon. And
yeah, I'd have to, you know, go out there and get my nice big copper tubing and fill it with organite and do a great big winding of copper and then like start, you know, use a Rife frequency generator to put like the Schumann resonance through it. And I'd have to, you know, I'd have to actually make this badass, you know, staff of cloud busting and try it myself to really know. It's one of those things where there's, you know, so many things you'd have to honestly test it yourself to really know. And if you could validate it, then you would, then I'd say, sure, it works. But yeah, well, then also you can, there's cloud busting with your mind, with your just, you can say your psychic projections. So, I mean, you can, I've done it. And there's one thing I can say that not every time, but if you focus on a cloud and just, you know, be gone cloud, wave your copper water bottle at it, you know, you can just disperse that cloud. And that's one a person has to try for themselves and prove it to themselves one way or the other.
Yeah. And I also go back to that a lot because I'm, you know, interested in epigenetics and, you know, like Bruce Lipton's work, the biology of belief and everything. He's documented clearly in scientific literature, you know, very clearly that what we believe, you know, it helps manifest the future, right? And manifest reality and manifest the present. And, you know, that's everywhere. I mean, you know, the allopathic medicine people, the doctors, the MDs, they'll say it's the placebo effect, but they're describing the same phenomenon, right? Like if you believe, you achieve. So part of me doesn't want to believe that they're doing chemtrails to try to, you know, all this stuff. And part of me doesn't want to believe that they've completely erased huge parts of history. Like what are your thoughts on the Tartaria stuff?
You know, a great one for that is David Dubin. His channel is Adapt 2030. He talks about that quite a lot in, you know, long-term cycles on the planet. And I would say that there is definitely cities that have been covered and then built on again, or you can see erosion. He did a video recently where there's like kind of a, on the side of a rather steep coast, you know, there was a city, and the water had recently come up and eroded some of the, but people thought it was just cliff, you know, it's just earth, but actually there were buildings there that were old. So definitely we have parts of civilization, you know, were flooded with mud and then just built over again, or it was cleared out, or, I mean, we tend to see this. So I think, to me, I don't know the scale, but I know that we have had to rebuild or just build back on top of or clear out mud floods, you know, but the whole full-on Tartaria thing, I, at least on a small scale, sure. I'm not quite sure how big it's ever been. I mean, it could have been a global catastrophe, and that, you know, who knows? We keep finding civilizations under the last one.
Right.
You know, it's like, so. Yeah.
I definitely think they got history wrong a lot.
Yes.
In science in general, wrong a lot, you know, just, you got to think, how hard is it to try to figure out what happened 10,000 years ago, let alone like 300 years ago, but 10,000. I think the most compelling stuff that I read on that sort of idea is Graham Hancock's work. Have you read his stuff?
Yes. Yeah.
I love Magicians of the Gods. I read Fingerprints of the Gods, like when it came out a long time ago, and then I read Magicians of the Gods, and how they talk about the deluge, the great deluge. What's the name of it? The event, the Younger Dryas event, when the basic, they think that it was a meteor shower, a big one that hit the earth, and it broke up a huge glacier and created so much heat that this massive glacier melted, and there was a big deluge, and it carved out the Grand Canyon, and it covered, you know, a lot of muds happen, you know, mud slides or whatever, like mud floods happen. And he lays down a lot of good evidence and talks to like the leading geologists and experts and that agree with that this is what happens, and you know, goes away from orthodox history and archaeology a great deal. So people don't want to accept it, but I feel like they laid down enough evidence that that is happening. But then the Tartaria thing takes it way farther, because some of the main people behind that theory, they're suggesting that basically all over the whole world, Russia, Europe, South America, North America, all these places had a civilization called Tartaria that basically was everywhere, right? It was this great civilization, and then they just wanted to erase it all and then start over again. And I don't think the evidence is there as much. Like, I like Graham Hancock, because he's like, all right, this is a geologist. He's the best one. These are his credentials. Like, let's interview. Yeah. He's like a really good journalist. You know, he went to Cambridge, and he's a journalist, and he does it. He sources everything really well. I haven't seen that sort of sourcing behind Tartaria stuff, and I would love to see it if someone could provide it.
Oh, yeah. It's like, and there's so many things that we can study that we actually can see. You know, we might find Tartaria one of these days. You know, we tend to find things, but just like a Glocky, I can never say it right, but a Glocky Pecky, or I'm talking about. Yeah.
Pecky.
Yeah. Gubaki, yeah, that place. Yeah, over there in Turkey, you know. To me, I'm like, wow, that makes me want to go to Turkey sometime, you know, traveling the world and see things, is because that is a lot of mundane science about it. Also, there's a lot of really groovy spiritual science about it. I mean, in, you know, what they were depicting in the carvings and the stones and the pillars and all. And so, like, we didn't know about that until fairly recently. And now we're finding just, you know, it's a whole new world that we're finding. So yeah, I mean, we don't know history. We've been blatantly lied to, and then we keep finding history that's never existed before. Like a great one is a documentary called King Arthur's Britain. And it was on the BBC, I think, and it was just called King Arthur's Britain. And it was originally a couple DVDs. It was a couple like hour-long episodes. And this, I do not remember the guy's name, but he was an archaeologist, and it's all laid out. One can just find it on YouTube. It's all there. It's free, I'm sure. People have put it up there. But King Arthur's Britain, there might be things that are close to it, but this is like kind of a, anyway, or shows that sound like it, but it's not King Arthur's Britain. I'll send you a link to it. I'll find it. So, because just to be sure you're getting the right one. But this guy found that the Dark Ages never happened. Really? You know, according to his study, he was like, nah, you know, the early Britons, they liked the Romans because they had some technology they didn't have, but the early Britons were, they were writing Latin, they were educated, they, you know, were into Gnosticism, they had their own spirituality. I mean, there's all this stuff. So there was like this sort of relationship, and it was more like, well, you know, I'm a feudal lord, and if you're going to send me like, you know, 1,000 Roman troops, then I'll trade with you. You know, it was more of a, you know, trade relationship, you know. And then in general, the Britons began to just kind of dislike the Romans. They were getting a little bit pushy. And then Rome had its issues and the troops had to go back. And they were like, hey, you want to help us fight off our enemies? And the Britons were like, nah, because you're kind of a pain in the ass. So just get out of here. So anyway, that's kind of the, and he, I mean, a person can believe it or not, but I mean, he documents it. It's at least it's, you know, copper mat territory. I mean, to me, you know, it's because I'm like, it makes sense. And he's digging in the ground. The thing is, archaeology keeps getting better. You know, yeah. So there's things we can find now, like what is it, a ground penetrating radar?
Yeah, the LIDAR.
LIDAR. And they're just like, yeah, like these areas that there were cities were growing and continue to grow after the Romans left. And that's just LIDAR. We didn't have it before. So then you start realizing like, well, you mean the Dark Ages never happened? It's like, no, probably not. You know? So yeah, I think it's great to have that mindset. Maybe that's one of a real superpower, is that you're just willing to let your bias go the way you thought things were, maybe even the way you would have liked them to be, and just keep, put truth above all and just let it keep unfolding. And it gets easier to let things go, you know? I'm not quite ready to say that, you know, clouds are a government psyop, but you know, maybe you gotta, you know, keep your, don't be too open-minded. That starts getting to be dangerous just as well.
Yeah. You're very spot on with that. Your mindset is super important. And, you know, with the epigenetics and stuff, it's been, you know, mindset's everything, you know? So you can get in a mindset where you're so mistrusting.
Yes.
You're going to find what you're looking for, which is that you're being duped, you know, like you can get in that mindset and that's going to influence what you find, you know, and then you have the social media logarithms playing into that. They know what you want. They're going to give you more of that. Right. So you got to be really strategic in the way that you look at both sides of everything, because yeah, I know we're being lied to. It's obvious, but if we're being lied to by the government, why couldn't anybody lie to us? Right. Like, and yeah, there's just so much false information out there and it's like really hard. So you got to really look at both sides of the story. Sometimes you got to dig for the other side of the story. You got to dig for it being suppressed by Google and Facebook and everyone's suppressing things. I think copper is actually in that category because, you know, you can Google copper toxicity and all this scary stuff comes up, but it's not sourced well. And there's not a lot of science behind it. And the science that if you do trace all the way back, it's the science that was done faulty. And Dr. James D. Nicolantonio talks about the faulty science done, how it wasn't right. You know, Morley Robbins talks about it. There's another book, Jason Summel. He wrote The Copper Revolution. Mm. That's a good book. He was a skier and he basically was all into nutrition and he started supplementing copper for a different reason completely, but noticed that after the fact he was looking back and he skied the best years while he was supplementing copper, like his performance increased. Like, and so then went back and started studying copper and is obsessed with copper. And he's the one getting people to rub it on their skin. And make copper sulfate like in your, you know, in your house. So you don't have to buy supplements. So you can rub it on your skin. Mm. But yeah, so it's hard to find that information. You got to really dig for it. Like for some reason, And Matt may be onto something. He seems to think that it's DuPont plastic, you know, because the copper pipes were gold standard for plumbing for, you know, the last 67, well, shoot, almost 100 years. Like, now everyone's going to plastic, and you know, DuPont plastic is basically, they're a huge corporation, and that there's some lobbying going on, and they're basically trying to shut down copper, and they want everyone to move to plastic. And I think that's probably, there's a lot of truth to that.
Oh yeah. I mean, cause they took out, I mean, there's a, you know, don't get mad at me, DuPont, for saying this, but they, you know, it is widely held belief, and some, I think there's a good deal of research. I mean, I've skimmed some books on it where, they took out, they were originally who created reefer madness and ended up, you know, working towards lobbying to make, you know, pot illegal because, hey, you know, it was ultimately a real, a competitor to many of the things they were creating, you know? So you start thinking like, I mean, if that is true, allegedly, you know, that they had a huge hand in making, you know, marijuana illegal back in the day. Well then really, you know, suppressing copper is not hard. I mean, that's a pretty easy one. I mean, for them to do, because that's very stealthy. They're just suppressing the info, not necessarily taking anything away from you, you know, that you know of. And well, here's one for you with your line of work. What do you think about the cargo ship that thumped into the bridge? Like, was that, did that just happen by chance, or is that something funny going on? You know?
Oh man, I'm sure that wasn't by chance. I got that video. The first thing I thought of was, how do you steer all the way to the one side? I don't know if it was the right or the left. I watched the video one time. I haven't even looked into it. I haven't even been actually back to work since that happened, because I've been on vacation with my family and I've been working this business. But I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of crazy theories. Maybe the union did it. Maybe, you know, maybe a different union did it, I don't know what it was, but it just seems odd that, you know, they blamed it on a power outage, but the steering mechanism of a big ship like that, it was a cargo ship, right?
Yeah. Big ass cargo ship.
Yeah. The steering mechanism on a car. That's a mechanical mechanism. You know, you turn the wheel and it turns the rudder. I guess there might be an electric component in there, but like, if the electricity goes out, you should be able to steer the ship still. Right.
It's tough. And that's the thing. I think, man, that's one of the new renaissances, you might say, is where we've all become, I'd say, like since 9/11, especially, so many people have become investigative journalists, you know, in their own right. And you don't want to get too overboard where you think every, you know, look, some things do just happen and not everyone is a crisis actor. I mean, it's like, so, you know, things do happen just that aren't good organically. It just happens. But no, I was thinking about that because I used to work on loading ships and loading cargo ships. And I wasn't a longshoreman. I was actually in the military, but, you know, back in the day when I was younger, and we used to load equipment on ships because a lot of times they move equipment around the world, they put it on cargo ships. And so even if you got really lucky, you could go on the civilian cargo ship and you could, like, five or six of us would go to just maintain the equipment while it was at sea. And we loved it because it was just like, you know, in the military, you have to constantly be running in circles and doing shit. But on a cargo ship that's civilian owned, you just need to eat. That's it, you know. And so we loved it. But I remember being a mechanic. I was a heavy equipment mechanic, a diesel mechanic. I went and looked at the ship because, I mean, I was just curious. And I'm like, okay, this thing has dual, you know, like 48 cylinder, like a post cylinder, you know, diesel engines. And it's running an alternator, which is running like AC to DC. No, AC. Well, that's running a motor, which is turning the props. And there's two of them, and they have this great big ATS automatic transfer switch. And so in a sense, it's like running on one. And then if that one goes offline, it just goes boom, the other one starts running, you know, and the motors are actually running off batteries. So that transition is smooth. And I just learned a lot about
if it's kind of goes out, does the motor still run? Because it's got a battery, right?
It doesn't just stop because it's running off battery. You know, it's like it's kind of like when you have a surge protector at home, a battery backup. You know, if your power goes out, you got a little while. You know, so if the engine stops, then the other one kicks on and takes over. So I don't know if they're all built the same. I really don't know. But the ones that I saw were like that. And then also you've got a generator that powers it. And then I think you have to, like, maybe for the steering, you have to go and like turn the power onto it. Like there's a breaker or something. But anyway, yeah, just one of those things where the whole thing, it could have been exactly as it's advertised, but there's something about it. I just go, I don't know. I think tugboats pushing those things in and out of port all day. And this one decides just to punch it and go straight into the bridge. Like, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It just doesn't.
It be with them in the bridge, going under the bridge. That might be a new thing they have to do. You know, tugboats stay with you till you're through the bridge.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, it could have been an accident. It definitely needs to be investigated. It needs to be investigated. I'm sure they're going to do an investigation on it. We'll see what they say.
Yeah. And that's just the thing these days is I think people go, yeah, you know what? We'll probably never know the truth, but we'll everybody's like I love it these days that everybody is sort of like their own, you know, investigative reporter. Cause they go, yeah, you know, I got like myself, I don't know if it was an accident or if it was some kind of sabotage, but I just got a feeling that, I don't know, something doesn't seem right. Just something about it doesn't seem right. I just got a feeling, you know.
Well, I can tell you this much. Work has picked up in Norfolk, Virginia.
Yeah.
New York City. Mm. You know, the guys in New York, they've had some history up there of pulling some strings.
Oh. So,
yeah. I'm actually part of the union, so I think the unions are great. Don't get me wrong. I read Grapes of Wrath, and I was like, we need unions. I also mm-hmm. think there's been a big sort of abuse of power with unions. You know, like they have basically been corrupted, you know?
Yeah.
Just like any huge organization does get corrupted. And so there's that. You got to look at that. And just because, you know, there's a time and place for unions and I think they're beneficial doesn't mean that they're also not possibly responsible for catastrophic stuff happening.
Stuff. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Yeah. People, if it was some kind of a sabotage, that kind of, it's like, yeah, who did it, you know, and then why? It could be an incredibly mundane reason like that, where people kind of are looking at this. They're thinking, oh yeah, this is going to take out global shipping and this and that. This is, you hear all the people on YouTube, you could say, you know, who are like, yeah, this is like this plan by whoever, you know, which is all very entertaining. But as you're saying, it could be something incredibly mundane. I don't want to say mundane, but mundane, like a much smaller picture. What's that?
Union people want work. They want more work.
Yeah, it could be a very...
But then again, they're screwing the union in Baltimore, so I don't think that's something the union would do. But, I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibilities by any means.
Yeah, so there you go. So now off to the internet, there's even more now. After watching this, people, you know, there's even like there's more wheels inside wheels, you know.
Yeah, there's gonna be a lot of theories about this one for sure. I'm not going to watch it. I don't think I'm just going to, I'm going to focus on different things.
On copper and if clouds are a government psyop, the important stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Well, it's been, I don't want to keep you forever. I had you for a little bit over an hour as it is. Well, it's been great talking to you. And I mean, definitely everybody, you know, check out, Vesla Copper. And it's just, you know, VESLA copper.com. You know, it's a beautiful website, beautiful products. One of the things that I love about the water bottles is they're beautiful. I mean, they're really little works of art. So, I mean, a lot of artistic effort went into it. And I don't know, that definitely matters to me. It's nice to have something that's functional, good for your health and the planet, and you know, happens to also be made beautiful. Because I think that maybe something we're missing in our society is beauty. You know, things being made beautiful just for the sake of it. You know, absolutely. Like there's a great street poet in New York, a guy named Speed Levitch, and he did there's a documentary about him just called The Cruise, and he used to sit up on top of the tour buses and do these amazing history of the city, and he was quite the, you know, performance actor. It's Speed Levitch was his name, and it's just called The Cruise. You might find it on YouTube.
The Cruise.
The Cruise, just The Cruise, yeah. And he gets into, like, when you're, I don't know, like, we call it, 10 people tend to call it flow state now, you know,
yeah.
But he called it The Cruise, you know, and right. And there was The Cruise, and then of course there was like the nefarious anti-cruise that was out there. And you know, somebody asked him, you know, why did the buildings in New York used to be beautiful? You know, so much effort was put into them when it was harder, but yet the beauty seemed to be important, and now they're not made, and now that's not the case. And he, like, for a moment, I guess, thought about it, and he said, it's because people felt beautiful. Ah, I thought that was really amazing.
That's an interesting, you know, perspective, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever read the, I got more time if you do.
A little bit, yeah, definitely.
Like six. Oh, wait. Oh, it is six. Yeah, I got to get off soon. Never mind.
Okay.
Have you ever read the book, The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand?
I haven't. Of course, I know who she is, but I've never read that book. Yeah.
It's the Fountainhead. About an architect. And he basically, really? He would basically be anti-cruise. Because he's like the beauty of an object is its function. And if you design the form for the function 100%, that's why it's so beautiful. Whereas like the older architecture, like you have like these gothic you know, like you have
gargoyles
architecture, but they're not like, and if it's in a house in my neighborhood, if they have white columns, it's not supporting anything, it's just there for looks. And
yes,
to his taste was completely grotesque because it was not there for a function, right? It was a waste. Yeah. It wasn't efficient. It wasn't economical. It was. And so like his whole thing was like, it has to be part of the function of the building to be beautiful. And anyway, it's a really good book. Ayn Rand's one of my favorite. Have you read, her masterpiece?
Atlas Shrugged.
Atlas Shrugged.
Only a little. I never got through it. It's a big book. I've never gotten through that one, you know.
I had to do the audiobook because it's easy. Yeah. Okay. I do big ones on audiobook because I couldn't get through it either.
I'll have to try it on Audible. Audible is one of my, you know, favorite things in the world, actually. You know, I don't know how many I've got to have, you know, I've probably invested enough to buy a small house in Kentucky in Audible books. You know, because if you can't read it, listen to it, you know. Yeah, look at
like
that.
Driving, you know, like I work, I do such monotonous things at my day job at the port that I can listen to an audiobook while I'm doing it. I'm just basically confirming the right boxes are coming off of a ship and the right ones are going back on. And I've done this for 10 years. I can listen to the audiobook and actually pay attention to it. And I've listened to a bunch that way. Yeah, I love it too. It's amazing to have that outlet.
Yeah, hopefully that ship captain was not listening to Audible.
Probably said the same thing.
He's like, yeah, I can totally like pilot this boat.
Oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't do that anymore.
Oh gosh. I'm sure you got it down. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Craig. I really appreciate you having me on, man. And this is fun, and I hope to stay in touch with you and maybe do it again sometime.
Oh, definitely. You know, and if I ever actually see Copper Matt, I'll tackle him and I'll get him on the show and I'll give him your card and say, you know, you got to talk to this guy too. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll get this up. I'll send you a link to it when it's done. I'll get this all fixed up and upload it, and I'll send you a link to it. And I think we created something fun and powerful, and I look forward to, you know, I know the next day or so we're going to order some cool copper jugs too. So look forward to those. So we'll be like a living, you know, sponsor, I guess you could say, you know, get these, you'll like them. So take care.
Yeah. And if I can help you in any way, I'd love to. I took a little cruise through your channel, and I definitely am interested in all the kind of stuff that you post, energetic stuff. And, I love that stuff. It's so interesting to me. So,
yeah. Well, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Any way that I can. I love the work you're doing. So thanks again for having me on. And
oh yeah, we love the work you're doing. So it's mutual. It's good stuff. So yeah, take care. And I have a feeling we'll talk again.
Yeah. All right, Craig.
All right. Take care. Day, buddy. Bye.